Like to call the March 19th Senate Resource Committee order. Like to bring attention, committee a memo from my office laying out the procedure on amendments and also added information on proposed amendments. Today, we're going to hear from Explorers and Independents. The order of testimony will be from John Zager with Chevron first, then we'll go off-net to Pat Foley with Pioneer, then we'll come back to Juno and finish up with Mark Hanley from Anadarko. So with that, I'll turn...
Mr. Chairman?
Oh, Senator Stevens?
Before we get started on the testimony? Mr. Chairman, after reading the bill after a third or fourth time here, I found an inclusion in the committee substitute and its substantive change of policy in referring to the tax credits on page 11, line 13. And Mr. Chairman, I how this got in there or why it was overlooked in the presentation of the bill, I find kind of disturbing, because it allows the transferable credit to be used against the corporate income tax.
And I don't know, that could have been another drafting error.
Well, I looked in all the other versions of the drafts, and it's not in any of the other version of the House version or the
If you look at the memo today.
But it's not in any of the other versions of the draft. That's why I'd like to find out where the language came from and how that got inserted in there.
We'll find out, but if you look at your memo today,
that line is not included in the memo. The one we picked up the other day was section F on line 14, and I might add, Mr. Chairman, that is different language that is in the House bill, that was put in the House bill, but more importantly, line 13, which refers to AS 4320, which is the corporate income tax chapter, is not in the House version, it's not in the governor's version, and that's a major policy issue in terms of allowing the transferable tax credit to be used against the corporate income tax liability. And it was not discussed, and I stumbled across it and sort of put my ears back.
Yeah. Well, we'll check and see where that came from and then let you know.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
If I could, just referring to the same, I missed the meeting yesterday, although I was on the telephone with it. The paragraph above that, I'm dealing with the...
Which line?
Line 7 through...
Oh, okay.
Okay, down to 13. Talks about the reduction. The intent is still to have a maximum reduction of 20% on the
credits.
Credit or the tax due. So you cannot move your tax liability down more than 20%. So you're always going to be paying at least 80% of the taxes, regardless of the rate we set. And right now we're talking 25% tax rate. We cannot move that down below 80% in any given year when you buy the credits as a purchaser. Is that?
I believe that was in the House bill. I don't think it was in our bill.
It was in the original bill. I thought we were still operating under that. Or we can clarify it later.
We'll check that on the 80%.
We'll check that. It just ties into that whole tax paragraph.
Okay, Mr. Zager, the floor is yours.
Chairman Wagner, members of the Senate Resources Committee. For the record, my name is...
Before you get started, I'd just like the committee to know that Senator Dyson's online from Anchorage. So, welcome, Senator Dyson.
Greetings. What have I missed?
Nothing.
For the record, my name is John Zager. I'm the general manager of Chevron's assets in Alaska. With me today is Kevin Tabler, who's the manager of land and government affairs in our office. I have a slide handout that we'll just refer to during this presentation. I previously provided testimony to this committee on March 1st, and the summary of that is that at that time we would support the bill, and the key terms is written with one main concern that we had, and that was the effects that it could have on the Cook Inlet and the very different nature of the Cook Inlet versus the North Slope. And the other main message I wanted to leave was to urge you to consider that when you start to make adjustments to the bill, what I called all the levers didn't get pulled in the same direction. So where we are today is we applaud the recognition of the current CS that the Cook Inlet cannot support an additional tax. I know there's been a lot of discussion about, we think that's the right answer to help Cook Inlet maintain production and really the right answer for Alaska. However, because of the substantive changes in many of the areas, we can no longer support this bill in its entirety. And we'll go into a little more detail of that, of course. First, we'll just try to address the Cook Inlet provision head on. There was a lot of discussion several weeks ago about the difficulty of crafting one bill to fit every asset in Alaska. And I think that this bill was drafted primarily, if not exclusively, with the North Slope in mind, and that the Cook Inlet was not largely considered. In my previous testimony, I talked about the difficult financial position of the Cook Inlet. If you recall, some of the issues there were that our production levels are a fraction of what they used to be. The Cook Inlet once produced 200,000 barrels a day and is now under 20,000 barrels a day of oil. Simultaneously, the water production is now over 90% of the water, of the total fluids in the inlet. Platforms are now 35 to 40 years old, and as you can imagine, running a 35 to 40-year-old car is a lot more expensive than running a new car. So all of those things play together. We talk about the Cook Inlet, we're talking about less than 2% of the oil production in the state. And these are the least profitable 2% in the state. So I don't think we're talking in the overall scheme of things about a huge financial impact. Another component here is the number of employees. Yesterday we heard that ConocoPhillips, the state's largest producer, employs about 900 employees. A big component of our expense is our employees as well. Chevron employs 385 people as opposed to Conoco's 900. So there's a big component of the expense that's tied directly to people. But 385 does include some full-time contractors. I think on a comparisons basis, you can see our labor costs per barrel are just astronomically higher than the North Slope producers. Another unique thing about the Cook Inlet, I believe, is its position and its value to the South Central economy. It's basically what fuels the economy. The gas produced here, as we all know, heats the homes and runs the power generation. And I don't think you can overemphasize the importance of the Cook Inlet in providing that service. And also just the power it provides to the Kenai Peninsula. Those 300 employees roughly we have in the Kenai certainly support other employees. We hire a lot of contractor and other service companies down there and really are the anchor tenant on the Kenai gas and oil and gas business. Another component of the Cook Inlet is the codependent nature of the production there. There's a small infrastructure in the Cook Inlet that's supported by our assets, by all the assets there, and once any of those assets become uneconomic, then the remaining fixed overhead costs will get shared amongst the fewer remaining assets, sort of a domino effect where one starts to fall, the fixed costs will be allocated amongst fewer assets, therefore driving them more uneconomic. Examples of that would be our shore bases in the Nikiski area, our onshore treating facilities on the west side, the Cook Inlet pipeline, which serves the production in the Cook Inlet. If a major part of the production there were to cease, then those costs would be allocated over the remaining barrels, potentially doubling or tripling the transportation costs in the Cook Inlet. So as part of our testimony last time, we presented a couple of options to consider of things that could be done to help the Cook Inlet. Ultimately, the current CS contemplates carving out the Cook Inlet oil production, and that is a route we could go. I'm not saying that's the only route that could be used to achieve these end results. We just need to keep in mind the primary concerns we would have is that we do not increase the tax burden on the Cook Inlet, which is already very marginal, and we continue to provide incentives for additional oil and gas development. One thing to consider, the important nature of the Cook Inlet is, I would make the prediction that sometime in the next decade, if we don't see additional gas exploration, this body or other bodies here in Juneau will be considering whether to build a state-subsidized gas pipeline to the Cook Inlet in order to provide the needed energy to fuel that region. That could be a spur line, it could be a bullet line, but I don't see a viable alternative to gas as the energy source for the Cook Inlet. So if we don't get it from the Cook Inlet, we're going to have to get it from somewhere else. And depending on whether the main pipeline has been built at that point in time, could be some very difficult decisions sometime in the next decade on how to get that gas to the Cook Inlet. You heard from some of the large producers yesterday. I agree with many of the points that have already been raised relative to the specific aspects of the current CS. And I don't need to probably elaborate on those too much. They were well presented yesterday. Our feeling is that the balance in the original bill is gone. I wasn't at the table, but my sense is that that bill was highly negotiated between two parties or more than two parties, but give and take, and that often results in the best solution that all people can live with. Since then, there have been significant changes made to that bill, and we believe that the original bill is much more balanced. Additional levers that we can talk about that have been pulled, the tax rate, raising it from 20% to 25%, I believe is a clear disincentive for further investment. Changing the April 1st commencement date, I believe it's more practical considering we're the middle of March. That will force, again, producers to make some guesstimates of the tax they might owe with these high interest rates and punitive penalties for guessing wrong. And, you know, this has been, at least with some of us, an issue for a number of years now, that 11% interest rate really tips the balance too far in the favor of the state when it comes to audits, which often don't happen for 2 years after the event occurred, and then you're retroactively charged 11% for something that is just, you know, not intentional, but somehow there was an audit adjustment that needed to be made, oftentimes resulting in a larger interest penalty than you actually have in payment. The transitional capital is greatly diminished. I know under the House bill, the Chevron transitional capital is reduced by about 80% per year. Your bill, I believe, will be slightly more favorable in that it's allocated over 4 years instead of seven, but nonetheless, the total amount is reduced on this proportional to the House bill. As far as we can tell, the standard deduction is lost. This is the $73 million deduction. In the CS, I believe it said it was replaced with this capital credit or additional credit for exploration. But if I understand the proceedings yesterday, it sounded like the decision or the high probability is that then exploration credit will now be deleted from the bill, bringing us back to a 2020 provision with no additional incentives for expiration and without the standard deduction. The idea of progressivity is another one that is new to both of the CSs, the House and the Senate version. I know there's been quite a bit of discussion about the intent of the CS. Literally reading it as it was written, I understood it to be a 0.2% rise for every $10 in price, but I suspect that the intent was 0.2 for every dollar increase would put it more or less in the range of the increase contemplated by the House. So with that, if that is a correct interpretation, that is a very, very significant adjustment to the bill, especially starting it at 40% instead of, or at $40 a barrel instead of $50 a barrel. I mean, at today's prices of around $60, we'd be at a 29% tax instead of a 25% or a 20% tax as originally proposed by the governor. And some people may think that, you know, taking away the high price, taking away the windfall, there's just a lot of extra money there and it should be allocated differently. From the investor's standpoint, though, that's part of the expected value of any investment we make. And I can use an analogy here that perhaps some of you will help relate to a little better, and that would be a fishing situation. Suppose you owned a fishing boat, and I know if commercial fishermen are anywhere like my fishing trips, some days are a lot better than others. And on those good days, it could be argued that you made a windfall profits. And so let's say you took a fishing company and said, we're going to take your 60 best days out of the year, and we're going to call those windfall profit days, and we're going to take up to half of your earnings on those days. Would that change the fisherman's view of the business? I suspect that it would, and it certainly would change his view of making future investments in that business, knowing that his upside, his best days are going to be capped and may actually not be as good as some of his other days. So in the oil industry, it's not days that we're talking about. The cycle moves in years, even decades. And right now, we're definitely in one of the good days relative to pricing. And so it's tempting to look at that and say there's windfall profits there. But in the overall scheme of things, investments are made on an expected value and a distribution of possible outcomes, which include higher price scenarios. So you can make that decision, but it will affect people's investment decisions. Other issues that come to mind, the escalation is tied to WTI, West Texas Intermediate. We're selling ANS, Alaska North Soap Crude. In my mind, there's often a disconnect of anywhere from $2 to $6, I believe the spread changed last year, and why we should be pegged to something that doesn't relate directly to the product we're selling, I think, should be examined. And to stretch that to the next limit, or to the next step, we're also pegging our gas production to West Texas Intermediate, which is a real stretch, being if gas is sold off the North Slope someday, it will be tied more to a Henry Hub price, no doubt. And gas sold in the Cook Inlet is under longer-term contracts, usually, and not at all tied in any way to WTI. So those are things that I would urge you to consider as you look at further provisions of this bill. And I think overall, increasing the taxes here will just make Alaska less competitive, relative certainly to the original proposal. And you can argue, I expect one way or the other, as we've heard between some of the majors and some of the consultants, about the overall effect relative to our position in the world markets. But I think it's hard to argue that increasing the tax won't make it less attractive. And certainly relative to North American investments, which usually are, from an investor standpoint, given a premium because of their low risk, it will certainly put Alaska at the bottom of the distribution for North America investments. Looking over to page 5 now, a few more general comments. What I've perceived here is there's a debate going on between kind of two schools of thought. One is, let's get it now. Let's get the most revenue off the oil and gas business we can now while it's still good, versus what we call a grow the pie option, where we take a longer term view, try to invest, and keep the production coming. And those are kind of the two endpoints of this discussion, and I understand there's rationale on both sides, and that's the task that you gentlemen are tasked with trying to solve. The get it now option, increase taxes as much as possible and get as much revenue in the short term, will balloon state revenue. That puts a real onus on the folks here in Juneau to make sure that they're good stewards of that capital and it is well managed for future generations, because you're taking a lot of money now and you're saying, we know how to manage that and make sure that even if the oil and gas business declines, as at least some of the investors are predicting it will, then we've got this capital and we know what to do with it. The grow the pie option, to me, will create more opportunities, long-term opportunities for investors and for Alaska. And I personally am very optimistic about the ingenuity and technology available in our industry and the people who live in this great state, and the ability to extend that production at least well into the next generation. So that's, you know, as simple as I can frame it, kind of the discussion and the debate that is going on, as I understand it at least. And then my next point is certainly not a shot aimed at consultants, but Consultants will one day leave, and we'll be left to deal with our decisions. I am not questioning at all the integrity, the knowledge, the expertise, the goodwill of the consultants. They got a tough job. They're hired to provide independent advice, and I believe they're certainly doing that to the best of their ability and working very hard at it. So it's not a shot at consultants at all. I very much appreciate their work and understand the difficult nature of their work, the many assumptions they have to make to come up with reasonable expectations of where these scenarios could go. As was mentioned yesterday, I believe they really don't have any skin in the game, and that's probably good. They should be able to give us then independent advice to the best of their ability. But the next step is for the House and the Senate and the state in general to vote, and you vote on the behalf of the people of Alaska. That's your solemn duty, and from talking with many of you, I know that's taken very seriously and fully recognize the gravity of the situation and the size of the issue you're dealing with. So that's your responsibility to vote and do the best job that you can for the people of Alaska. But then over the coming years, investors will vote with their dollars. We'll either be coming with more, we come in with less, coming with about the same, but that will unfold, and there are a lot of variables that will affect that, including future gas prices, prospectivity. If for some reason prospectivity changes, you can see more people coming in. Technology could change that, and certainly the fiscal terms we're operating under will change that. But that's kind of the landscape where we're headed, and that is really be the measuring stick of how well we have measured and made a judgment about where best to place these various variables. And so then over the last few days, industry has been coming here and telling you, well, you've kind of stepped over the line. We could live with the first bill. This bill is much more difficult for us to swallow, and in fact, we would suggest that we can't. Of course, an obvious reaction from your folks is, well, of course that's what you're going to say. You work for industry, and you should always be against higher taxes, what we're paid to do. And there's certainly an element of truth in that, but one thing to measure about the sincerity, I guess, of the people who are here in front of you is that originally industry support came out and said, this is a huge increase in taxes, and I think it's quite astounding that everyone, from the biggest to the smallest, came in and basically said, this is something we can manage. We know the game's changing, and this looks like a deal that both sides can live with in good faith. However, today, those same investors, big and small, and I won't presuppose necessarily what the people talking after me today will say, but I expect they'll have some additional comments about reasons why the new CS has gone to a place of all the cumulative effects and all the different areas where it's very difficult for us now to say we can support this bill. And so that's kind of the lay of the land, I think, that people came here originally, all sincerity said, this is tough to swallow, we can do it. Now we're looking at the changes and we're back and saying this is just not a place where we think the industry should go and where the state should go. So just to summarize, on the final page, Chevron cannot support the Senate CS in its current form. We urge return to the original PP terms while retaining some provision for the Cook Inlet. We know that structuring that, there's a number of different ways to approach, and we're certainly willing to work and make sure that it makes sense for everybody. And also take the last point that I have off my previous testimony. Chevron has been in Alaska for many years and intends to continue an active exploration and production operation in the state if a sound fiscal and stable fiscal regime can be offered. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I thank you, and I'll be glad to accept any questions.
Thanks, John. Question to Mr. Zager? Senator Stedman?
Yeah, if I could back up in your testimony a little bit, you had mentioned earlier that and referred to numerous points that made you uncomfortable, one of which was the escalator clause or to move off of the 2520 and make it even a higher rate as oil prices advance. And at $60, you used a total rate of, I think, around 61% for a government take. Wasn't that correct, I think?
Through the chair, Senator Sedman, I only referred to the incremental effect on the PP tax. I wasn't trying to look at the total government take.
Okay.
I believe I said at $60 a barrel, which is roughly where we are now, that would be, I believe, 29% tax rather than the 25 because of the escalator, that we would see an additional 4% growth because of the escalation from $40 to $20, from $40 to $60 as we are today.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, depending on just using Econ One's numbers, they did one scenario where we went from today out to 2030 and then another one at 2016, and they're within like 0.5%, depending on which data set you're using. The one I have in front of me is the one that ends 2016. But when we look at that escalator triggering at $40, it in fact moves it higher than the 25-20, which I think your estimate's pretty close to what the consultants are telling us. But if we, from $40 a barrel, it's roughly 16.5% total government take. That includes federal government. So the industry's left with almost 40, up to 61.8. But if we go back to the $30 number, it's about 50 basis points or 0.5% change, because we have a regressive proposal in front of us in total. And I think we'd all agree that the current PPT is progressive in nature, but not at such a magnitude to override the other regressive issues that we're faced with, which is our royalties and taxes. So I guess it depends on where we want to measure it from. But clearly we would agree it is higher than the 25-20 at $60. But I'd also like to just point out that under the current scenario, the from Econ One's analysis, if there was no escalator and it was just 25-20, the government take figure would be 60 instead of with the escalator at almost 62. But the current system would put us at 50, almost right under 53%. So the biggest magnitude of change is just getting from our current system up to the 25-20, and under the House version to 2020, then the incremental difference. So I'm not disagreeing with your numbers. I'm just saying that when we put it in the entirety, the picture looks a little bit different, and I would have to agree with you. It is a tax on the industry. There's no way around that. It is a tax increase, and it is a substantial tax change.
Further questions?
If I could make a...
Senator Stedman?
I heard the point made changing on this escalator again, instead of West Texas using ANS. And I think the industry has a point that we should take a look at that, and I think some of us are going to do that. There's some cleanup work and some issues that we need to work on as we get feedback, and back and forth. And I'll yield the floor, but I'll have a couple more.
I don't think there's any other questions. Senator Terrio?
Hey, just on the couple issues that, with regards to whether it's, just get more money now and whether the state will act prudently on that. Certainly, the legislature has mechanisms by which it can set extra revenue aside if we believe that either this legislature or future legislature might not act prudently with the amount of cash that we generate. In fact, I'm working with Ledge Legal on a mechanism to do that now. So just to let you know that there are those of us that are concerned about, if a pile of cash is accrued by the state, how we can perhaps make sure that wise decisions are made on what to do with it. On the grow the pie part, though, would you agree that with the mechanism of the credit, it encourages the industry to grow the pie, but specifically to grow the Alaska pie? because the current system really makes it fairly easy for industry to generate a dollar and to take it wherever they want to in their worldwide operations to get the highest highest return for the company. And that certainly, that's business decision, and that makes sense. But from the Alaska perspective, we're interested in allowing you or trying to incent you to reinvest that dollar to specifically grow the Alaska pie. And what's proposed in the PPT is it's a new mechanism to incent that activity.
Through the chair, I believe that's right. There will be additional incentives to invest in Alaska, but they will still be measured against your worldwide portfolio, which is dynamic and changing constantly. So it's hard to predict how that might look 5 or 10 years out. But the reinvestment credit, you know, I believe, especially for the smaller companies, will have a positive effect on reinvestment. It's really a risk-sharing mechanism, as I think has been mentioned before. And I think people's desire to share that risk with the state will vary depending largely on their risk tolerance and their financial position. The trade-off for sharing the risk up front is giving up value on the backside. I mean, we clearly recognize that. And so a lot of the bigger companies are probably quite willing to make the investment on their own if they can be exposed to the full range of results. So it's hard to answer that specifically, I believe.
Senator Stebbins, you have more?
Well, I was just to the point of the issue as I see it, Mr. Chairman, is not the issue of trying to increase state revenue to meet our budgetary requirements. The issue is a changing global marketplace and how that global marketplace is putting a value on the commodity that the state and the people of the state own, and how that relationship between the producers and the governments are in flux around the world. And we have a system in place today that was put in place several decades ago, which is structurally flawed. And in front of us, we have the desire to build a multi-billion dollar gas line. It has more to do with that, those dynamics, than it has to do with our needs for expenditures. I think it's up to the state to run their expenditures the way they see fit and let the global marketplace set the value of the commodity that we're selling. They're two definitely delinked, and I think it'd be a sad day in Alaska when we, if we just ran our expenditures and then just went to the industry to balance our books. That is not the way we should operate, and that is not the issue on the table.
Senator Dyson, do you have any questions?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. I would enjoy if the gentleman is testifying could give us a rough idea of what his company's profits in Cook Inlet were like 10 years ago and 5 years ago and 05. I don't want him to have to betray confidential information, but I'd like to know what the trend and the magnitude of the profits have been for them in Cook Inlet.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I don't have that information with me today. Over that time period, the production on the, if we're talking about the oil, has been quite dramatic in its decline. Of course, that is going to be offset by the increased oil price we've seen over that time frame. And without having the numbers with me, I can't say for sure which one is going to win. I know we're certainly more profitable now than we were 2 years ago, but versus 5 to 10 years ago, I can't say right now.
Yeah. Can you give us any rough idea? Is it 20% more profitable than it was 2 years ago?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I think I would be stepping outside my bounds of comfort if I gave you any numbers right now.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Additional questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Zager. Appreciate your testimony. Appreciate
thank you.
You taking the time to come down today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee.
Next, we'll go to Pat Foley, who's online for Pioneer Oil. Pat?
Yes, sir. Can you hear us?
Yes, sir, I can. Can you hear me okay, Gavin Jr.?
Yes.
Very good, Senator Wagner. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Pat Foley. I'm with Pioneer Natural Resources, and I'm the manager of lands and external affairs. Let me start, thank you for allowing me to first participate in this whole process. Pioneer is kind of a tiny little company compared to everyone else that that you've heard from on this matter, but we're trying to do big things here in the state. Thank you also for allowing me to do this over the phone. It's a little difficult to come to Juneau on a moment's notice. Sort of the common theme that I think you heard from all of the investors, and Pioneer would share that theme, is that we all believe that the governor's initial, the administration's initial proposal was a balance that everyone could accept, but we're concerned that as this bill evolves, the balance is being tipped to the disadvantage of many of the investors. I've testified before you before. I apologize for going over some of that again, but it's important to remind you, I think, of exactly who Pioneer is. And you'll remember that we're new to the state. We came up in 2003, but we jumped into this with both feet. As I speak to you today, we're actively hauling gravel to build an offshore island out in the Beaufort Sea at our Ugrit project. On a gross basis, this is a $500 million development that will develop between 50 and 90 million barrels of the state's resources. It should start up in 2008 and should have a peak grade of about 17,000 barrels a day. 17,000 barrels a day is huge for a company like Pioneer, but it's kind of an average Kuparuk drill site, relatively, minor in the grand scheme of things. But again, for us, it's huge. Also, this winter, Pioneer's drilling three exploration wells. In fact, we're on our second well now, and the third well should spud within a week to 10 days. Over the last several years, Pioneer's drilled six exploration wells. We've also got another project down in the Cook Inlet, which is a development project that we hope to make some go-forward decisions on later this year. Pioneer is deeply committed to this state. We have built a purpose-built light exploration mobile drilling rig. It's called the Arctic Fox. We've got a long-term contract on it, and Pioneer fully intends to drill three or more exploratory wells every winter for several years to come. And I tell you this story because Pioneer, we consider ourselves to be the face of a new entrant to Alaska. We are the face of a new explorer. And I'll tell you, what we'd like to do is just be a face in the crowd, but the reality is it's pretty lonely. And personally, I think it's in the best interest of the state to help foster an environment that has many, many new entrants as opposed to a handful every year. In our industry, we're pretty good at analyzing risks and trying to control them. And generally, you could sort of group risks into a few baskets. There's risks that we can control. There's risks that are beyond our control. And there's risks that we believe the state, through its policy, can control. The things that we can control are our costs and trying to make the best decisions we can. But clearly, there's some things beyond our control, such as oil price, exploration success, and will our developments ultimately perform as we predict, the reservoir quality. And that comes to the third issue, the things that the state can help control. And we believe that PPT is an integral part of that. You all are faced with the difficult task of finding the true balance point that is genuinely in the state's best interest. We can appreciate that the PPT is designed to take a little bit more during good times, and in exchange, you're willing to give a little bit when times are tough. And all of this, I think, is intended to create a vibrant industry that attracts heavy investment.
And again, we believe the administration's proposal did a pretty good job of finding that balance point. And I caution you to stay as close to it as you think you can. So specifically, as the tax rate goes up, and as the $73 million exemption is stripped away, we believe that the investment-friendly climate that was intended to be created by the administration's proposal is starting to turn a bit cold. I previously testified the significance to Pioneer and to all new entrants, and certainly to all smaller companies, the significance of the $73 million exemption. As I understand, that exemption is no longer in this bill, and I'd encourage you to find some other mechanism that replaces it. The startup costs for a new company up here are just enormous, and the risks are high. I think that many of the giant fields that open the slope are just not left to be found. So we're kind of fighting around the edges trying to find smaller things and make a little bit of money on. In this exemption, in whatever form you ultimately agree to design it, it's huge to help the little guy and to help a new entrant get his head above water before it's pounded by a relatively high tax. As others have testified, it's clear that your group is considering some kind of a progressive nature to the tax. I guess my word there is that you need to take into account the fact that at high oil prices, investors' costs increase dramatically. Pioneer's personal experience last year, 2005, the cost to drill lower 48 wells in development increased by 50%. And we believe in 2006 we'll see an additional large jump in our costs. At the beginning of today's call, I heard Senator Stevens discuss the language which perhaps had been inserted into the bill by a company's ability to use credits against income tax. I can't take credit or blame for having that inserted. I can tell you it would be greatly beneficial to a company like Pioneer. We believe that many of the credits that this program is designed around, there is substantial value. A company can't quickly and easily monetize those credits. In previous testimony, we suggested that the state could make those credits refundable. The state could establish a floor at which they could purchase those credits at some kind of a fixed discount. And then the third thing that the state could do is allow the credits to be transferred to and utilized by any company that paid income tax in the state. And the thing that this enables a company like Pioneer is it substantially broadens the pool of companies that might be willing to purchase those credits. And most importantly, it broadens the pool beyond just the existing large oil producers. So, investment decisions, all of the companies you've heard testify are extraordinarily good at wrestling with hard, difficult investment decisions. And occasionally we have decisions that are easy. Things are wildly attractive and it's easy to make a yes decision. And more frequently things are wildly unattractive. It's easy to make those decisions too. But I think most of what we wrestle with are relatively marginal opportunities that are right on the ragged edge, and it's policies like this PPT that will actually have a huge impact on whether you push some of those investment decisions to the yes column or to the no column. Earlier today, and I've listened to sort of BP and ConocoPhillips' testimony, and I just listened to Chevron's testimony, and they talked about the number of employees they have in the state. We're a little pioneer. We have 26 people here in the state. And I'll tell you, three of us are deeply involved in all this. So 10% of our workforce is focused on this issue. And I'll tell you, for small companies, if the state wants to encourage new entrants and smaller companies to do business here, you need to craft a fiscal policy that makes it easier and not harder for the little guy to get in the game and keep his head above water. And with that, I really have no other comments, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions of Mr. Foley?
Yes, Tom?
Yes, go ahead, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. I was quite impressed with the increase in your drilling expenses. Was that mostly an increase in your fuel costs?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, no. The fuel costs are certainly an element, but the largest driver are the day rates. The money that we have to pay to those that own drilling rigs, you know, drilling rigs are in limited supply at today's oil prices. They're under huge, the demand for them is extraordinarily high, and they get the prices that they deserve.
Yeah, okay, and that's helpful, because I had been assuming that higher oil price generally just meant more money in your pocket and ours, but you're saying that the scarcity of rigs has driven up the day rate and therefore the cost of exploration. Am I right?
Yes, Senator, through the chair, you're exactly right. I think it's sort of a common belief that as oil prices increase, the profit margin widens right along with that price increase, but that's not true. Costs increase and increase dramatically. I think they're a little out of phase. I think that prices go high, people get confident that those prices might remain high, they start large investment programs, and they all compete for those same scarce resources, and the costs go up.
All right, so that your costs only for an oil company are really only going to go up if you're doing more exploration or development, but just maintaining the same operating environment, it would only be a slight increase in fuel costs. Is that correct?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, no, I think that's not correct. I think even the operating expenses will also increase because the, you know, the monies we have to pay our labor force will go high. All of the capital, just operating oil fields, there's quite a large number of capital investments that take place every day, and the cost structure of every one of those investments will continue to rise.
It continue to rise and track the increase in retail or oil prices. Is that what you're saying?
Now, Senator Dyson, through the chair, I'm not sure I could make that direct relationship between cost and oil price or cost and CPI or either any of the other inflation indexes. And I will say that directionally, as prices go up, costs will also go up.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Foley, you have your remarks in written form.
Senator Webb, I have them. They are scratched on a notepad. I can take the time to reduce them to writing and submit them to you.
If you would, send them to Mary Jackson, my office. I'd appreciate it.
It's very good, Senator.
Any further questions, Mr. Foley? Thank you for taking your time out Sunday afternoon to present to us, Mr. Foley. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Now we'll go to come back to Juneau and go to Mark Hanley with Anadarko.
Mr. Chairman, it's going to take me just
let's go off record for just a few minutes. We'll be right back with you. meeting back to order. Mr. Hanley, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Senator. Senator, for the record, my name is Mark Hanley. I'm the Public Affairs Manager for Anadarko Petroleum, and appreciate the opportunity to come before you today and discuss a few issues. I'm going to use some slides. They're not any different than I've used before to make a few points. I would just say to remind you what our position was on the original bill. I think you've heard it from other people before. We felt there was a delicate balance. I described it as a tenuous truce between companies. There was some downside to it. We were paying more in taxes, but we felt like we did have some downside protection, and it did improve our exploration economics. So the trade-off for the higher taxes for us was the improved exploration economics. And I think that's in line with what folks are trying to do here, because let me just go. One of the things that I think we need to focus on is this was an editorial in the Daily News, not generally favorable to the oil industry. That would be my view anyway. But it talks about the forecast for declining production on the North Slope, and I think that's what our goal as a company is. We view ourselves as an explorer. We want to find more oil. We want to stop that trend, and I think that's a goal that's shared by a number of people. And to the extent that people need to keep in mind that the total revenue source from new production is not just from production taxes. It is royalties. It's corporate taxes. I think you're all aware of that. But I want to focus again on how we're going to look at this, how we see this thing affecting us, this bill. And I'm going to go to a couple charts just to show you how we look at things. And I was going to show you our charts, but I think I'm going to go to Pedro's. I downloaded his PowerPoint. This is just from his report, and this is just one field. It's an example of a field. It has a lot of assumptions in it. It's a 150 million barrel field, and it shows a net present value basis how we would analyze the economics of a field. And I believe these are development economics. I'm not going to go through all the things. I think he did not include the 40% credits that exist today under his existing system. I think the existing system should look a little better than under this system. I think there's a couple other factors, but I do want to point out, and this one has the 25-20 on it. If you look at the existing line, and you look at the yellow line, and again, my point being, even under today's current system, I don't think we have enough drilling going on the North Slope. That's an assumption I'm making. I think we're having a declining production. We need more. And so from our view, the system needs to improve exploration economics beyond what the current system is, or you're not going to get additional investment. And I'm not talking about existing fields. I'm talking about new fields. And this is Pedro's chart. So as you can see here, this yellow line at 25-20 with no 73 million, and we can talk about with it. But if you look at his, I don't know where it is, $36 West Texas, from our view, the 25-20 with zero is worse than the current system. It will not incent on a 150 million barrel field more exploration. Now, again, if you look at the 25-20 with the 73 million, you can see the lines are converging here. The pink line at the top is still slightly better if you look at it that way. But as you get up to higher prices, I think if you'd extended that out, they will cross. So even at higher prices. So to the extent that you make changes in the bill, our testimony was based on the 2020. We thought our expiration economics, if you had a 2020, he did not have the 2020 in his chart. So I'm just telling you that. They were better, obviously, than the lines were higher than the 25-20. And that's one thing I wanted to make, because there seems to be a feeling that 25-20 is better for expiration than 2020. And I think that came about because of some testimony from Econ One that suggested at low prices, and you can see that on this chart, at low prices here, our economics are better, and which would argue the state is getting less money. That is the downside protection we are picking up, but we are giving up some upside. But I will just tell you, at the numbers at which we do better, exploration isn't better because it's not economic. I mean, if you get in those low prices, none of our fields are economic anyway. So I want to just tell you, a higher tax rate does mean poorer economics for exploration. So again, to me, this is the big focus. We will run the numbers. We will look at the issues. But to the extent that you reduce the $73 million, and I think I shared that with folks before, the $73 million is very important to smaller producers and new players than it is to existing producers. And you can see that on this chart. That pink line is significantly higher than the yellow line. To the extent that that, for our company, as we look at this bill as a whole, and I think I testified to this before, if you just reduced, if you took 2020 and reduced the $73 million, it would have a similar effect to raising the tax rate on us to 25%. So the $73 million is worth about 5% on the tax rate. So you eliminate that, it goes to 25. So if you take the 20 to 25 for us, and you eliminate the 73, it's like going to a 30% tax rate. It does not improve our economics, and in fact, in most cases, I think it, you know, if those two things happened, you would find that most of our projects are worse than they are under the current system, which means we will drill less wells, not more wells, under the current system. So, again, the balance in the original bill, and this is what's ironic about the whole system, how did the state get more money and still improve economics? I mean, that's a bit counterintuitive, because more taxes generally means less activity. It's balanced by the credits. So the credits that were involved, as was mentioned earlier, do incent you to invest, but they also offset that tax increase. And I think even one of your consultants suggested, to the extent that you raise the tax rate, if you want to have the same impact on our exploration economics, and I've heard debates between, it's not a direct relationship. So a 5% tax rate increase and a 5%, so if you went to 25-25, that is worse for our exploration economics than 2020, because there's not a one-to-one relationship. It's a 4 or 5 to 1. So if you wanted to keep the exploration economics the same, you need to, you know, if you're going to take something, you got to give something back. And the credits, for instance, to go to 25% would have to go up by 5 times the 5% increase in the tax rate. By 4 would be a 20% credit increase. So probably, and it's not exactly linear, and I think Daniel Johnston suggested, you know, 4 or 5 to 1, but somewhere around the 25-40 keeps your expiration economics the same. So, again, what we see in the bill generally is a tax increase that decreases our economics, a reduction of some type. We're not sure, and I understand this is all being worked on the $73 million, but it sounds like it's going to be less than the full $73 million value. So that will reduce our expiration economics. Overall, the changes in this bill do that, and it probably, we haven't had, until when we get the more details, we can run some specifics to see exactly where on this line it comes, but I'll just tell you. And the other thing you can see here, when you talk about progressivity, what you're going to do from our perspective, let's take that yellow line right there. You can see how it's trending kind of up this way. If you do a progressive tax rate, when you get to $40, what you're going to do is see this line flatten out from our perspective. It'll still maybe go up, but it'll go up not on a straight line like this one is. And so the difference between the existing system, which would be up here, is going to be even greater. So essentially, you know, and that's the point, is you're taking more of the high side. So where you put that high side is going to make a difference. If you're going to increase the tax, where you start the progression makes a difference for folks. I would just say some of the, I heard the testimony saying that, you know, companies look at a, and again, we don't disclose our numbers for what we use as a hurdle price, but you heard consultants here saying companies look at about a $40 hurdle price. So it's got to, you know, you got to make some money at that $40. That's the numbers you're using, but they will stress price it at $30. And the concept is absolutely correct. We will take a number that's our hurdle rate. We will take a low rate, which is maybe $30, to see if we even have cash flow at that level. But we also take a high rate. Now, we might take $55 or $60, but it'll be something on the high side. Companies generally do play for the high side. So it's important to realize that to the extent that you are doing a progressive tax increase, it does affect our decisions. I think there was some thought that, hey, we have a $40 price, so anything over $40, you know, we've already made our decision. It won't really impact our economics because we're not using that in our planning purposes. And I would say we do use it in our planning purposes. Do we use $150 in our planning purposes? No, but there is the high side that we do look at. So to the extent you take some of it, it also has that impact of reducing expiration economics. So I think it's important to point that out. The couple of the specific details, I would just say that on the progressive rate itself, I think it's been raised here, applying a gas tax increase based on an oil price is not a proper thing. I mean, if a Saudi oil field gets attacked and the price of oil goes up to $100 a barrel, raising the tax rate on gas is not a good idea. It may or may not go up. And in fact, gas could be going up and oil isn't going up. So the two shouldn't be directly linked. I mean, there's other factors that are out there. Mr. Chairman, we've talked about that, and right. I think we're aware of that, but I just want to make sure we do agree with some of the comments earlier that if you're going to have a progressive system, which we would prefer you didn't, but if you are, then I don't think that the gas price should be linked to oil or vice versa. I would also say, as was raised earlier by Mr. Foley from Pioneer, if you start a price at a certain level, it's unclear to me whether this is the tax, I believe, is based on the gross revenues. Is that correct? Is that the intent? When you have a progressive tax, I'll just tell you, in the House bill, their progressive tax is based on the gross. It is not based on the net. And if that's the goal here in the Senate, I will just say the cost factors have an impact. Let's just put it that way. If you base it on the gross and you start it at whatever number, $40 or $50, 10 years from now, it's likely costs will be higher, even for us in the oil industry. So to the extent that there's no inflation adjustment on the base number, there's an assumption there, I think, that the costs haven't gone up and that there's an ability to pay more when our costs may have gone up. So I'll just say that is a concern to us as well. A lot of talk about a level of government take. I think it's a factor you obviously look at and you should look at, but if your goal is to get more, I would say I don't know what the government take is under the current system today. People feel it's too low, but I will also say people feel at today's level investment is too low, at least in expiration. So be careful about just saying government take needs to go up, because if it's too high for expiration at today's level, going up doesn't improve that. So it's only one factor that you should utilize, I think, in the discussions that are out here. And I'll just tell you, even on this field, that looks pretty good. There aren't a lot of if there were a lot of these 150 million barrel fields that provided us decent returns, they'd be drilled now. People aren't not drilling them because they're trying to wait. I think there are other factors. This is just one example. Typically, you're going to find your costs are higher than are used in a standard model. Because they're farther from infrastructure than a standard model. They're further up a pipeline. People tend to use an $8 differential between West Texas and a wellhead value on the North Slope. Well, that's about $2 between West Texas and ANS West Coast. Then you back out maybe a $2 per barrel transportation in the tanker and $4 per barrel TAPS tariff. People have forgotten the farther out the line you are, there's another buck to get to Alpine. And if you're farther than that, there's other things. So again, the danger with looking at one particular model, it's illustrative of what happens, but be careful about assuming that every field that's up here has these same economics. They tend to be worse because they tend to be, if you're going to find a 150 million barrel field, they tend to be farther away. So again, I will just, we have a number of little issues. I think I've heard that some of them are getting taken care of, and we'll be happy to work with you on them. But the main point I wanted to leave you on, as Mr. Zager, I think, said, it seems like the levers are being pulled. The tax rate's going up. The allowances are going down. And they're not being replaced with, any credits or that type of thing. And so to that extent, our economics are decreasing. And I'm concerned that our economics are going to end up being worse than the current system, which is, I think not good for us as a company. We want to drill more wells, not less. And as Mr. Foley said, I think we have a lot of prospects out there that are on the edge or just under the edge, so some increase in those economics would be helpful. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
We'll see if we can tip that the other way.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Senator Dyson, you have any questions of Mr. Hanley?
I do not.
Thanks, Fred. Questions? Senator Stedman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A little bit ago, you'd mentioned about this escalator issue. A couple things. It's on the net like the regular PPT because we're going to change it from 25 and escalate that 25% tax to a little higher number.
Okay. Through the chair, Mr. Your intent then is to have it on the net. Is that correct?
Right. It would. We could think of it another way. Right now, we have 25 on the table at and a trigger at $40. So at $50, it's going to be higher than 25. At $60, it's going to even be higher than the $50. It is on net, and the language, regrettably, is a little dysfunctional at this time, and we're working that out. On your chart up there, at the higher end, at the $40 and above, and there's been a lot of talk about $30 being a stress price and $40 being the upper band, and I think we'd recognize that, you know, there is some numbers used higher than 40 and a smaller probability used on it in the analysis of the company from their viewpoint. But when we put in the escalator, it is not, the intent is not so much to grab the upside above this $40 range, but to keep the state or the government take, because it includes the federal portion also, but to keep that government take from ever getting smaller as we go from 50 to 60 to 70 to $80 a barrel into the future. But I do recognize it does impact marginally your analysis on the upper end, and would most likely bend those linear lines slightly down above $40, and you know, we don't definitely want to bend them into the ground because you won't be here to drill. So I recognize that.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Additional questions, Mr. Hanley? Senator Terrio?
Just on the escalator, I've been trying to figure out, and I know that Senator Stedman is working on that, but I think we do have to be careful, though, of having an escalator on that, you know, that trigger point. And, you know, I think we've got an example right here that you're aware of. On our constitutional spending limit, we had an escalator on the old limit, and it just, year after year, ratcheted away to pretty soon that number was, you know, was an absurd number, something that was never going to be achieved by the state. And so basically it rendered the constitutional spending limit completely ineffective. So I think we've got to be mindful of that too, trying to be sensitive to, you know, realizing that over time your costs might in fact go up, even though we've had some testimony that technological breakthroughs help keep it down, but we do need to make sure that we don't hook in a system that it just ratchets up every year, and pretty soon it's, you know, it's a trigger that's never going to be thrown. And then with the investment is too low at today's system, just wondering if you have a comment on that, you know, my criticism of the existing system, which makes it very easy for you to take your dollar return and go somewhere else with it. And this is a systematic change to try and, again, get you to invest that dollar to grow Alaska's pie, you know, for your benefit and for ours. And whether, you know, if you factored that into the comment about whether, you know, the level of reinvestment that we've got now and what we're likely to get under the new system.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Terrio, I think that the system has worked as it was presented. I mean, you have the credits that do encourage additional investment, but in the end, we look at the economics. I mean, if the economics are worse than somewhere else that we have to go, then we're not going to invest here. It doesn't matter. And I guess that gets back to my point. The state did come up with a system that increased the tax revenue to the state and yet improved our economics through the credit. So to me, it did work. You got more money and it did improve our expiration economics, at least the way we looked at them generally. So I think that worked. To the extent that you start changing that now, and to the extent that certain lines decrease those below the existing system, well, we'll continue to evaluate. But just because you have credits, if the expiration project here is better than here, or we can't make enough money on it here in the state, then we're still not going to invest. So I think you're right. It was a kind of a counterintuitive approach that allowed the state to get more money and still improve our expiration economics. And my only point is try and keep that balance, I think, if you're going to do that. And if to the extent that you don't, I think you will see either the current decline curve or a worse one if you move that line below our existing system for investment for new expiration, then I think it will mean we drill less wells, not more wells. And I think you can see that decline go faster.
Mr. Hanley, a question. Yesterday, one of the majors said that even at 2020, they did not feel they had the incentive to invest to keep production up at a higher level. You're not insinuating that dealing with exploration, are you?
No.
Okay.
No, Mr. Chairman. That's the difference. I mean, the reality of the tax increase is it is on existing production, and the reason it's so large is because the existing production does not get the benefit of the tax credits for the previous investment that was made. Forget the look back for just a minute, but I mean. Really, so as I said, we're kind of got a foot in both camps here. We're going to probably pay more through our existing production at Alpine, but we see ourselves as an exploration company. Those exploration economics have improved. So really, the higher amount of money is being paid on existing production, but you have increased, at least from our view, the exploration economics for new projects. So that's the balance, and to the extent that we pay more at existing production and our economics are worse than the current system, then it's not as, you know, it's to us, it's not as good, obviously.
Senator Elt.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Mark, for your testimony. And I always hate to do this because I'm working a little bit from memory, although it was just yesterday. The governor's consultant, Pedro Van Mieres, Dr. Van Mieres, showed us a chart. And I don't have it with me, but I think it was slide 7. And on that chart, he purported to try and analyze investment, for lack of a better word, incentives. And he ran across the top was 2020, 2520, 3020, 3015. And there were two lines below that. One line was for large companies, the other for small companies. And he was suggesting that for large companies at 2520, slightly less of an investment incentive than when measured against the governor's proposal. But across the bottom, for the smaller companies, the explorers, he was suggesting that there was going to be more investment no matter what the rate was. So I'm curious, after hearing your testimony today, I'm curious, you know, for maybe an explanation of where you think his assumptions might be wrong that got that line that said explorers are going to invest more regardless of the rate.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, I haven't seen his slide, so it's a little difficult, but I don't mind talking a little bit in general. I mean, at any rate would be, I mean, then, you know, a 75-10 or, you know, I mean, at some point you can't just tax 75% of this stuff and say it makes it better for our economics. I mean, generally speaking, as the tax rate goes up, the economics go down. Could you have a better, in some cases, even up here, this is Dr. Van Mier's chart, does the 25-20, and that pink line is the new player with $73 million at $40, 25-20 does look like it's better with the full $73 million than the existing system. Not much, but you can see it is slightly better. If he had the line of 2020, it would be above that line, so it would be even more, you know, a better improvement in your economics. So I'd have to see a slide to see, but it doesn't sound inconsistent with what he's saying here. You could have a 25-20 that slightly improves your economics, but I would go back to what I think Daniel Johnston says. You kind of have to put a smile on people's face too. And, you know, a very slight increase in or if it's so close to the existing line, I mean, it's all a matter of level. Are you going to see a big increase in exploration drilling if all you just go up a sliver over the current system? And I would say the 2020 got us to the point where we felt like it did make that difference, and we probably would drill more wells and would help us. Whereas 2520 is just bringing it back down, and particularly as you start shaving away those other issues on there, adding a progressivity, all of that tends to bring us down at least two, if not below, the current system. I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah, I'll share the slide with you.
Okay.
Senator Terry.
Thank you. For Senator Elton, the calculations behind that were done on the expected rates of return and whether the rates of return would change enough to alter a company's investment decisions. And so it's not an exact science. It's sort of a band. And of course, you can't lump all the committee or all the companies together either. They all have different investment expected rates of return. It's my understanding that you know, the chairman is working on language to, you know, perhaps a different mechanism for the 73, which is important to companies like yourself. There's the possibility that, you know, somewhere in the process we'll consider additional incentive on pure exploration, which again adjusts the numbers. So we know that we've got a lot of these different levers and how we can push and tug on them to make it so that it is attractive and does get you to invest more. You mentioned the look back, and I'm just wondering how much you just followed the discussion yesterday of a mechanism that allows maybe a 2-for-1 to go back and capture a previous investment dollar. Your company, I think, I've seen some sort of gross totals on investment from the three majors. I don't think it included information from your company, but your investment over the last 5 years has been substantial. And if we match that up then with what we think we can incent you to do in, you know, the next couple of years, I'm just wondering, have you given any thought to that 2-for-1 or some kind of a multiple, and whether that does excite you to invest more so you can go back and take the benefit of those previous investments?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, does it excite me? I'd rather have a 1-for-4, I think, or the other way. But I think we have made hundreds of millions of dollars of investment in the last few years. I think I told people before, we sanctioned a project at high oil prices in 2004, December, for two satellites at Alpine. We spent hundreds of millions of dollars. We have not received any revenue from them. They're not coming online yet. So to the extent that folks were concerned about people already having recouped value from decisions they made fairly long ago, we haven't done that. So I would just say, will it, that versus nothing? Yes, that is something, because we intend to continue investing. To the extent that you have made a change midstream and we haven't had a chance to incorporate it, I would say the original look back type approach is preferable, obviously, to us. But to the extent that that's what we would prefer. But if that's not going to happen, anything that we can do to get credit for the money we spent and decisions we made already is helpful.
Well, I guess Dr. Van Meer's comments or criticism, I guess, of the look back was that, you know, it's all sunk cost to the company. And if the mechanism, the credit mechanism, really is to, you know, direct or shape future investment decisions, you know, his pitch has been that, well, that may be a mechanism so that you are taking into consideration some of those previous investment dollars, but the state's getting something out of it too. And you and I have had the conversation in the past of, you know, this new system being like a bicycle, let's both push on the pedals, and is that going to be the incentive to get you on the bike? Well, let's pedal together. So
through the chair, Senator Terrio, I think it will have a minor impact on whether we go forward. I mean, the fact that we can capture some of this money going back, to the extent it's not even one-to-one, it'll have some minor impact, but not a lot on our, we're going to make decisions in the future based on what they are. It'll be helpful, no question, and we'd rather have it than nothing. But I'll just say again, and just so you know, those two satellites, one of the things, the decision we made, it was at high prices. We did not anticipate that they would ever probably pay a severance tax. Now, that's part of the problem for some folks, but I will just tell you that some fields are not economic if they have to pay a severance tax. I know there are other companies here that have had to come before you that did not anticipate paying severance tax, and they had to come in and actually get royalty relief to make those things go. And I think the state made a choice that getting some royalty, corporate taxes, property taxes was a preferable solution in that. In that circumstance, despite the fact that there might not be severance taxes ever paid under the old system. So again, the satellites that we developed are probably not likely to pay severance taxes through their field. So to the extent, like I said, we see this as quite a large tax increase. Can I tell you whether we would have decided if under this current system? Now, here's part of the problem. Like the folks from ConocoPhillips said, if you had told us 2 years ago you were going to go to this system and we could have got the credits for it, we might have had the same decision. If you told us 2 years ago we were going to have this new system, but if we, you know, invested then, we weren't going to get the credits and deductions for them, I'm not sure we would have. And I don't know what the answer is, but that's part of the issue. It's kind of like, if we're going to go to this system, I sure wish we'd have waited because, you know, it might be better for exploration and new development under the new system, but we weren't able to take advantage of that. So we kind of feel like we got the worst of both worlds for those two satellites that are existing anyway.
Further questions from Mr. Hammond? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we can back up to the comparison at low oil prices, the 25% tax versus the 20% tax, you know, each with a 20% credit. You'd mentioned that, you know, the 25-20 is not better at low oil prices, but I think the consultant was trying to, Econ One was trying to zero in on the value of the credit mechanism, because under either scenario, in their examples for explorers, they wouldn't be paying a PPT tax anyway.
Through the chair, I would just say, I think the main point, at those low prices, we don't have economic projects. So I think there was, to the extent people felt like 25-20 was better for exploration, it is not. To the extent that 25-20 versus 20-20 at very low prices might cost us less money than under the existing system, it could. So I don't think they were absolutely incorrect in what they said. If you look at the lines and how they cross, the slope on a 20-20 is less than that. But I think people were left the impression that 25-20 is better for exploration. And if we had to run our exploration at those low prices, I got to tell you, we wouldn't be drilling any of these wells. So that was my main point, is that 25-20 is not better for exploration.
Can I have another question? I think you brought up another point, gas versus oil. And using oil as a benchmark for gas. I'm not very clear on that myself, and I'm still working through that. Because there is a multiplier used on gas of roughly 6, I think, if I remember right, but that changes, 6 to 1, but that changes depending on market conditions and swings. And I think currently, isn't the multiple substantially different than that with the high oil prices relative to the gas?
You know, we've got an amendment suggested by Dr. Van Mears that the House put in that addresses that, and I'll get you a copy.
Okay.
Through the chair, I think that's the approach. The eventually, when you have gas production, you're going to have to come up with some place, probably Henry Hub, just like you do with oil. You're going to take an oil price, work it back for transportation, get to the wellhead, multiply times your volume, that gets you your wellhead value. You're going to have to do the same thing with gas, but you're going to take some Henry Hub price, work it back for the tariff, you know, to Chicago and then on up to Alaska if that's how it goes, and you're going to get a wellhead price. You're better basing it on that approach for gas, because that is what it is, mm-hmm. and just having a gas price because you're going to have to do it for the wellhead anyway. And that was my only point, to have a gas tax increase based on what happens with oil prices doesn't make sense. So, but I think they've figured out something.
Just for the record, just note, Rob Mintz is working with Pedro on some of these language change, and they'll have that to us on Monday.
Okay.
And that'll be on the 2-to-1 versus in addition to the other one on the
gas escalator.
The different escalator for gas. So we should have those in hand Monday sometime. Additional questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Hanley. Monday we'll hear from the public at 3:30. I guess that's tomorrow, isn't it? And also, Dr. Van Meers was going to appear again so we could have a little more of his presentation as far as questions to him. And hopefully at that time we'll have a couple of these amendments ready to discuss with. So with that, meeting's adjourned.